you?
Here.
No, I'm not a writer.
Okay.
Hi, Ashley.
Hi.
Welcome on the bus.
Thank you. So excited.
Are you?
Yeah.
Scale of one to excited.
Wait, sorry.
Scale of one to excited.
One to excited. Ten excited. Wait, what's the scale?
Ten excited is a good scale.
Ten excited.
This is your first podcast?
It is, yeah.
Oh, wow. You're a podcast fan?
Yes. I was actually listening to one when I was waiting for you guys.
Which one were you getting warmed up with?
We want to know. True Crime Obsessed. Jillian Pensavalle, Patrick Hines.
It's a hugely popular show.
Yeah?
True crime?
I didn't know that. Yeah, yeah, there's My Favorite Murder, which is like the big one. Mm-hmm. But then there's this, they're funny. They're funnier, in my opinion. Yeah,
this guy took my straw, so now
it was my idea.
I'm going in, say, raw dog.
Oh, no.
But that's a new trend that we had to experience when we got back here, that people do not want to use straws anymore because,
that's right.
I mean, I don't know who's going out there and saying, hey, guys, I'm coming here from the Pacific Ocean, and I don't want you to use straws anymore because that's the main problem. And that's if you could do one thing there back in Brooklyn, it just don't use straws. And
well,
that's doing your part.
You know what? I have a glass straw, and I carry it with me everywhere I go. It's actually, it's not with me today, so that was a lie. But it's, you know, save the sea turtles. I really like that, like, you know, a couple people came out and are like, straws are bad for the ocean. We're going to ban straws. But, you know, we haven't banned guns yet, so there's always, you know, it's your time and place for everything.
It's one step at a time.
Exactly.
But that's the thing. I mean, do we say to people you're not doing enough, or do we say to people who are living in a different part of the world who are, you know, big players in how things get done and how things happen, should we be demanding more, that they have more responsibility, even if they're not by the Pacific Ocean, they don't get to see, they're so disconnected. We're disconnected where we are because we're in that epicenter, New York City. So what do we want to demand on people? You're talking about, you know, guns. We're talking about stop using straws.
Yeah.
They're both killing people. They're both killing our environment or animals.
True. Yeah. I think that the straw thing is a pretty good idea. I mean, honestly, like, it's been years and years and people have been talking about, like, waste and the human, like, our waste and how much plastic we throw away. And, you know, slowly but surely people are doing little things like doing the banning straws. I don't know if they should be, like, totally banned. I think there are some places that have compostable straws or that are still, like, they feel like plastic. Mm-hmm. And you can use those because
the
there are people.
Are
the paper ones are the worst.
Worst.
But there are people that, like, you know, for medical issues or something, like, they can't just drink out of a cup. So, like, I think banning straws in places like Starbucks or something is not the best idea because some people actually can't drink something without a straw. But, you know, it's like baby steps. I think it's good.
It's lead by example, though, right?
Yeah.
We're the powerhouse. I mean, that's how I view us. We're the powerhouse country. That's how we want to show people. So if we start doing things like that, people are going to follow. They're going to say, okay. I mean, it doesn't always happen, right?
Well, that's what we talked about with one of our last guests, James Kirchick. And, you know, how do we be that example for, you know, liberal democracy, you know, liberal values around the world when, you know, sometimes people have this, you know, very blameful mindset on ourselves for things we may have done in our past as, you know, as a country, as the United States. So we shouldn't go in there and do this anymore. We shouldn't go out there and have an active role in the world. But who else is going to do that better of a job than we are? Who would take our place? You know, which country in the world would you say is, oh, wow, yeah, we can trust that country. They're going to go off and be that much moral of a better judge on how to do things than we are. It's hard to say.
I don't know. Yeah, because we haven't really had that, like, been in that other position. It's tough. Also, because I don't really know. I mean, I haven't lived in another country, so I'm very much, like, America-based and focused. And, like, I know, though, that, like, our country is pretty, like, egocentric in that it's, like, it's very much, like, we are the example. Because we've always been, like, a big, you know, powerhouse. But it's hard because it's all I know. Like, I have no idea what other country could take the place of it. But I don't know if that's just, like, me talking because I've, like, been born and raised here and, like, everything I know has been about America, or because there truly isn't another country that could, you know, take our place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. Well, the first step, I think, is that you recognize that there's another potential perspective, right? I mean, you've traveled throughout the U.S.
Yeah.
When you were traveling, did you see different types of culture even across our own country?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Definitely. So it's a massive difference just within our own country to try to navigate the waters of America and then imagine stepping outside and having someone else take over. I don't think any of us can even picture that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing, that we're having such a hard time connecting, communicating with ourselves as humans because – not even humans, I mean, as Americans, you know, do you have people from New York or Silicon Valley, like going back into the center of America, you know, the flyover states to know like why people could vote a certain way, not even vote. But, you know, I think a lot of people don't understand the perspective of someone who's pro-life, like where they really think, and if it's a valid point for the way they think that any life from conception, I mean, that is a life, and any time you can kill it, any scale before you know during pregnancy, is killing a life, and that's not a bad value to have. But where is the respect on the other individual right of the person, the woman who gets to choose and decide?
Yeah.
But is that make that person a bad person? Are they not good people now? It's not true.
Yeah.
They're still people.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know what was it with one of the when Mike Pence went to go see Hamilton?
Oh yeah.
Did you work with Hamilton?
No, I did not.
No. Mm-hmm. What plays have you been in?
I've been with Rent, Beautiful, and now Mean Girls. Mm. Yes. Maybe Hamilton one day, but I know a lot of people in that show.
Mm-hmm. What was the aura like around here during the Hamilton issue?
I was on tour, but we all heard about it and we saw it, and I was like so on board and really happy about it, because I think that like a lot of the times, and I see it all the time, I see it on my page and I also see it on like people who I follow, especially film and TV actors, whenever they post something political or their own opinion, especially if it's political, you always get those people in the comments that are like, well, stick to acting, like nobody asked for your opinion. And it's like, just because someone's an actress or a singer or a dancer or someone in the arts doesn't mean that their opinion doesn't matter as much as like you, Randy, who's a manager at Home Depot. Like, who's to say that like I actually was on Rachel Brosnahan's page and she had said something, and it wasn't even like super targeted at Trump or anything. I can't even remember what it was about. It was just her expressing an opinion, and this guy in the comments was like, yeah, stick to acting, like stick to being a pretty face, like those types of things. And it's just like a lot of people don't expect artists to use their voice. And then on the other hand, you have a bunch of people demanding artists to use their voice because they have this platform. And so I think the Hamilton thing was pretty cool because like I don't necessarily think they were being disrespectful. You know, it was when you are in a show, that theater is like, it's not even your second home. It's your first home. You're there for so many hours of the day, of the week. And like when you have someone coming into your home, especially if you don't like, it's like if Mike Pence walked into my home, I'm not going to like kick him out and throw him out, but like I'm also not going to not say anything. I'll open up the discussion.
Can you describe the story again? What happened?
Yeah, yeah. So from what I can remember, it was after the show, and a couple people from the cast like stood up and they were just basically like, man, now I'm like, okay, I don't want to say anything wrong. But
was it before the show or after? Because I wasn't sure when the placement of it either. And they said, dear Mr. President, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah. And it was like, we foster like inclusivity and all this stuff. It was just mostly like about like, this is a show about immigrants. There are people of color on this stage. We don't agree with the message that you're promoting. This is our message. And I'm pretty sure that's the gist of it, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't think anybody has a problem with that. But I think it was what's happened to people that are in Donald Trump's cabinet or, you know, part of his administration, you know, they're literally, you know, getting booed. I think he got booed. The whole crowd just started booing and yelling at him. He didn't say anything. He was just standing there in the crowd, no matter what everyone said on the stage said. But I even think people like, you know, they go out to dinner now and they just get yelled at and chased out of restaurants.
Yeah.
And it's.
Who's getting yelled at and chased?
So Sarah Huckabee Sanders, his
cabinet members,
the White House press spokesperson. She goes to dinner. I think Ted Cruz got chased out of a restaurant, and yeah, they got ran out of places for, I don't know, they didn't make the policies or anything, but they got chased out for, you know, guilty by association, which is
I think it's tough,
very popular in the U.S. now.
Because it's not even a guilty by association. It's like they're not doing anything to actively or actively doing anything to stop this from happening or even voicing their opinion and just saying, like, I don't agree with what he's saying. Maybe they do. I think, you know, I think it, like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, like she definitely stands by the president and stuff. But like, that's what people are frustrated with. Like, there are so many people in this country that are just like, I don't see how anyone could agree with what this man is saying or what he believes in. But there are other people on the other end of the spectrum as well. Like, I don't see how you could not support this guy. And I think it's just tough because, like, being extreme on either end doesn't foster any sort of, like, collaboration or conversation, because those people are the ones that are chasing someone who at the end of the day is still a person, chasing her out of a restaurant. Like, I don't think that that's right, but I see where the frustration comes from.
Well, you know, I don't understand either perspective, but I understand either both perspectives a lot. And let me clarify.
Yeah.
So the people who are in Donald Trump's cabinet who are getting booed, right? Well, first of all, they're not actually implementing the policies, but they wouldn't. Trump is kicking people out who aren't agreeing with him, so they have to agree with him in order to be a part of his cabinet. So they are definitely responsible, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
They're not making the policies or anything. But then, if they weren't in, he'd find anyone else who just is going to agree with him.
Right.
And when it comes to standing up for the things that you believe in and those people that are making the comments on Twitter, do those people want? Okay, a career politician whose only goal is – who doesn't understand the who has never lived that other perspective. Like, they want a career politician who's spent their whole life, you know, in private school and gone off and studied law and then gone on to be a senator. And that's the only people that it seems that they want to make a policy, whereas an artist like yourself has a different perspective that we need to hear, that we need to listen to. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, those people, like NFL players, like, people get mad at NFL players, but an NFL player is in the same position. They have a unique viewpoint. I'm not saying their viewpoint is right or wrong, but their viewpoint is something that we should take into account and not just take on a politician whose sole life is their constituents and whatever they were raised. And they're making money from being a politician too. Like an NFL player isn't making money from being a politician.
Right. I think it's really interesting. And I think especially with NFL, like just using like – because Kaepernick's like the biggest thing that comes to my mind. I think that was also – it's not only like, oh, okay, like shut up. You know, your job is to throw a ball. It was also the fact that – and this is always – it's always going to come back down to this too, but it – because I am a person of color. But it was also his race too, because like men in America, especially like – young black men who are praised for their athletic ability, when you put them in that box, that's all you will ever see them as. And so when someone tries to use their voice or just, you know, because he was coming from a very like personal place and also a very educated place too. And then you have people saying that he's disrespecting the flag and our country. And then you've got veterans coming out that are saying like, actually, that's not what he's doing at all. He's not protesting our country. He's protesting the way he's being treated. And I think that, you know, if someone else had done that, you know, if a white football player had done something like that, they obviously couldn't, because they don't come from a history of, you know, colonization and like, you know, othering. But for some reason, if the tables were turned, I don't think the backlash would have been as strong. I think it would have been praised.
But that's exactly the thing. Like, why, number one, should any of us care about what he decides and chooses to do? The problem is, though, he works for a corporation. And it's the unfortunate thing is, you know, just like you want to say with these people in Trump's administration, they're doing a job. And they have to do a job in order to make a living. And it sucks because, you know, I can't help but see, you know, the NFL is like – these representations of, you know, like slavery or, you know, master, like, hey, I own these guys and I get to tell these guys how to do it and play my game and I pay them money and they got to do it for me. And it's kind of like this like weird outward form of, you know, ownership and possession of, you know, a majority of minority athletes, mm-hmm. and how they get to do it, how they get to live their lives. And if they don't agree, again, it is also business principle practice. Right. I can blackball you and you can't play in my league.
I think, yeah. And I think it's just, it's a little bit different too, because they are getting paid. So like, you know, he's getting paid. He's also a celebrity and he's, you know, a household name. And to not, you know, you're still like a person at the end of the day. You have opinions and you have like, they, like you said, like, why should people care or be upset if that's what he chooses to do? It's because of where he chose to do it, I guess, you know, being public. But like, that's the only outlet that he had. And now he's got, you know, sponsorships and a foundation and all of that. But none of that would have happened if he hadn't made such a political, like, statement, mm-hmm. you know?
The truth is, to push the threshold, you have to go where no one else is going. Like, realistically, that's what it takes for anything. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, your voice isn't going to be heard at the level you want to hear. Like, it takes something dramatic for people to really take notice.
But that's both sides of the spectrum. He knew what he was doing. He knew I may not have a job.
Right.
So, you know, if you're on his side, you know, there's a place to point your anger and aggression, you know, and you can steer it in a direction. You can steer it towards a path, you know. Mm-hmm. Hey, I knew this was going to happen to me. I understand what's going to happen. But you know, exactly what he's trying to do. I've got my foundation.
Yeah.
I want to start
he
discourse.
Took that risk.
Discussion. Yeah. I'm going off of the, you know, a U.S. soldier, or asking him what I can do in a positive way. And then you have the other side, which I still don't understand anybody who could just be angry or upset with what he's doing. It's just so many. And I want to know what you think about that, because it's like, what could you possibly be mad about this guy taking a knee because he's against police brutality against young African-American men?
Dude, the inflammatory NFL, who is only there to make money, saw it as a risk.
But people too.
They saw it as a risk.
I understand,
and
the
so
NFL
they
position.
Promoted they the NFL promoted the opposite side because they saw it as a threat against their economic system. And so to me, that, like, they promoted the concepts of, oh, he's taking a knee and it's against the flag. Like, to me, it was all the NFL. But
it's,
that's my viewpoint.
I think it also comes down to, like, of course, money and who's in power. So, like, you've got the NFL in power and these, like, rich guys who run this corporation or whatever. They've got all the money. And then, so it comes down to, like, the money and the power. You've got, like, the NFL, of course. And then you have got people who I think are just so comfortable with the way things have been for so long and the status quo. And that is showing up more and more, especially after this election. Like, police brutality is not something that just started. It's something that has always existed. It's something that's always been targeted towards people of color. I mean, just even the prison industrial complex just takes young black men, especially men of color and Latinos, and pulls them in and spits them back out. And it's just like this one this big cycle that doesn't stop. It's always existed, but now because of technology and our cell phones and people recording everything, now it's out in the media and people know about it. But like, that's what's upsetting people, because now, because you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, people are now talking about it and they're getting angry about it and they want to change it. And when you grow up your entire life one way, especially in a system that benefits you, and I'm talking specifically about, you know, white cisgendered men who are, you know, exactly you guys, but it's like, it's you know that you have privilege, you've grown up with privilege. But I think what upsets people so much, especially white men, is that having to recognize that privilege doesn't necessarily mean that we're saying, and I mean we as, you know, people of color, minorities, are saying like, well, you have privilege, your life has never been hard. That's not it. We acknowledge the fact, a lot of people acknowledge the fact, that having privilege doesn't mean that your life has been perfect. It just means that you've been afforded different opportunities that we haven't. And just accepting that privilege and saying like, okay, I understand that I have it. Like, no one's trying to make you feel guilty. Some people are, you know, there's extremes in every level, but it's like, I'm not trying to make you feel guilty about it. I just want you to acknowledge it and know that this shouldn't be normal. Like, historically, our entire lives, the history of America was founded on the backs of African Americans. And to carry that all the way up into present day, like, that's the problem. Like, we're not equal, and we're not going to be equal until people in power start doing something about it. And I'm not necessarily saying, like, oh, ultimate power, like the president. No, like, as white men, you guys naturally have more power, and you just have to sort of realize that and accept that and, like, figure out, like, what you – like, starting conversations with people like this, you know?
So should we – so just thinking of possible solutions, do you think we should relinquish some more power to people of color, or do you think that if, you know, if white men are in power
– power? I mean, because I also –
should we be more accepting in, like, what do you see in the power
tough,
relationship?
Because it's not like power is not just like something that you can just like, okay, here's like, you know, here you go.
Yeah,
like,
here's a bunch of money.
It's not a tangible thing. Yeah. And it's also not, it's so tough because I see, like, it's hard for me to put myself in your shoes because I, you know, just and vice versa. Like, I don't know what it's like. So, and I don't know if you've like spoken to other people before and they're like, well, it's not my job to teach you. Right? Like, it's not my job to teach you how to treat minorities, people of color, people with disabilities. Like, it's not my job. But then on your side, you're like, okay, well, then what do I do? Like, how do I know how to fix it or change it? And I think it's just
that's
mostly about.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Exactly. Because it's like, well, it's not, you know, I'm
I
not
can't put myself
to,
in your shoes.
Yeah, but
so.
No one wants to be told how and to be no taught one, to do something because that's when people get, they feel
defensive.
Very defensive.
Yeah. And so I think it's just like, for me at least, like, having an open mind and starting conversations and conversations that may be uncomfortable and that you think might make people uncomfortable, but like doing that with not with this like animosity towards someone. Because like I'm talking to you guys right now, but I don't feel any like hatred or animosity towards you.
Well, they've grouped us out of white men into because we're Jewish. So we've been.
Oh, so that's worse. I'm just kidding.
Depends who you talk to. Yeah,
for some reason, they've grouped us out.
Yeah. Well, it's tough, too, because, like, I'm sure, like, obviously, I don't know the plight of Jewish people, but, like, y'all have been through some. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, no.
This word? Oh, okay. I was like, y'all have been through some crazy shit, too.
You can say
but
yeah,
oh,
you
yeah,
can
yeah,
curse.
Don't worry. This is very explicit.
it puts you in a different category as – because I know people who are Jewish and they consider themselves people of color as well. So it's just like – and minorities. So it's tough because it depends on what you identify with and what struggle you identify with. But I think that coming from a place of – it, some disadvantage as well is helpful, but also recognizing that like not everyone's like we don't all have the same struggles.
No,
like
not at all.
You know, I'm not a black man. I'm not a Latino man. I'm not an Asian man, but I'm also not a black woman. I'm, you know, Dominican and Puerto Rican, Afro-Latina, who passes as black, but is also light. So I can pass, you know, it's very, very, very wishy-washy because within my community, you know, growing up, Dominicans talk about mejorando la raza, which means marrying lighter and lighter people to better your race.
Well, that's across a lot of cultures. I mean, even Asian cultures too.
Really?
Exactly. It's all this like European and whiteness and going towards that. And like, you know, the Dominican Republic we share an island with Haiti, and there's so much animosity between mm-hmm. the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And it's like, oh no, we're not Haitian. Like, no,
find
no.
neighbors that don't hate each other in every country. But yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's, there's, you know, prejudice within every single culture. And there's always that. It's like railroad tracks within everyone of – and it's because of the history of, you know, colonialism and the power that Europe had when they were conquering all these other countries. Like this is – you know, the European ideal is what everyone strives for. And so the more European you look, the wider that you look, then it comes down back again to that power, like the more power that you have just in our society because it's what we've been taught.
Yes and no, because I mean, some of these things date back, you know, even Mesoamerican cultures.
Yeah.
Same thing. Oh, we want the king or the queen, whoever is our emperor, to look lighter skinned. Thing. It's this. Some kind of appeal.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's the same thing with the Asian cultures. I mean, it's like you are literally a lower class citizen the darker your skin is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what, you know, Japanese, Korean, Chinese would look down upon someone who's more Thai, Vietnamese, who may be closer to the equator, have a darker skin complexion, but it's just melanin. And the same thing goes against, you know, I mean, racism against people who are African American or from Africa. It just had more melanin in the skin, which is actually a better defense mechanism against the sun.
Right.
It's an evolution tendency and trait. Mm-hmm. Makes no sense. I had to take it back for you about we're talking about people who may be not wanting to break outside the status quo.
Yeah.
And people who may not be against, you know, having conversations or about just change in general.
Yeah.
Are those people racist for not wanting to change, or are they just stubborn in their ways? Because I think that's the hardest thing about discussions. People don't, like you said, either want to have a discussion or people –
They're enshrouded in their culture and whatever it was, so they hate change.
We hate change, but is it fair to call them racist, or are they racist themselves for not wanting that change? Because you can even say they're mostly white people who are just like, no, that's it. This guy shouldn't be standing. But there's a whole other layer of overtone to it of why you don't want this black guy just kneeling on the sidelines.
Yeah.
There's nothing to do with patriotism or the flag or – being a traitor, but there's a weird overtone to it.
I think it depends, and I mean, I can't speak for all of those people because it's a little dicey, you know. I think that it depends. I haven't had conversations with all of these people, but everyone that I have spoken to about race, you know, white men, white women, the minute you pull out that R word, they're like, oh no, I'm not racist. I'm not racist. I think that everyone is equal. But it's just like, okay, if you're not racist, can we at least say that you've got some really, really deeply ingrained prejudice against people of color? It's these trigger words that just make people really uncomfortable. And I think that they don't want to have that conversation because they just immediately like assume that someone is going to think that they're racist. But like, I honestly think that it's something that we all have, that it's ingrained. Even if it's very slight or it's small, you have to be honest with yourself and know, like, and know what's going on in your own mind. Because even for me, like, I mean, and I know, and this is another conversation for a different day about the actual, like, history and root of the word racism. And I also, I mean, I don't have any degrees or anything. I'm just, like, talking. But, like, racism is very, at least in my mind, it is reserved for the treatment of black people. Racism. Because it stems from a history of slavery. You can't go and say, there's no such thing as reverse racism. That was a big thing. Like, oh, well, you're treating, you know, you're prejudiced against white people now, so that's reverse racism. No, that's not a thing. Racism, the word itself, is specifically reserved for the treatment of black people because of the history that it comes from. But there is prejudice. Like, I know for me, sometimes when I'm walking down the street and I'll see someone and, like, when I was in the Dominican Republic too, like, I know that my roots, I'm sure I have some Haitian in me too, but I think the way that I grew up, and not that my parents were really strict about it, but just hearing my cousins talk, my uncles and aunts talk, like, of saying, like, oh yeah, well, my maiden name is French, not like French Creole or Haitian. So like, oh no, like, our family came from France. It's like, no, they came from Haiti. Yeah, you know?
I know that, yeah.
Like, stop trying to, like, you know, distance yourself.
Whitewash it.
Yeah, and whitewash it. Like, they didn't come from France, they came from Haiti. And like, so it's just one of those things that, going back to what you were saying of whether or not these people are racist, it's hard for me to say because of the sensitivity of, like, of that word. But I know that the people that, at least going against Kaepernick and saying, like, there's definitely some, like, deeply rooted racism in there.
But look, biologically, it had evolutionary benefits. We're talking, you know, 20,000, 30,000 years ago to for the to have problems with the tribe next door, to have have problems with your neighbors. And actually, in experiments, if they do they do some experiments where they flash other racial groups on a screen so quickly that you don't have time to even recognize what you're seeing, but when you see your own group, extremely positive oxytocin releases and positive responses. When you see other groups, completely negative. It's it's literally inherent in us.
Yeah.
So being prejudiced is something that in the past could have had benefits, and it's inherent in you. Whether you can I don't think people can accept. Like, people will say, "Nah, I'm not racist. Yeah. I'm not racist." They can, they don't want to accept that it can be an underlying prejudice. Mm-hmm. But I'm also on the other side of the fence, because, you know, that still can be built within you mechanistically.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, you're right in that we need to find a solution for the future. Like,
right.
Okay, this benefited us in archaic times that mm-hmm. we're no longer living in. Like, now we live in a diverse culture where you're interlocking with people from different places, and you have to, in order for your society to succeed, it's not how can I go against my brothers and my people next to me? It's how can we work together and use our strengths and skills to surpass humanity into a different level.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I find it extremely fascinating. I'm also curious from you what you see in show business, like with that type of diversity. What's going on in acting was what was it historically white? It was historically,
not. Really? I'm trying to think now of what I remember, like, history of acting in school. But
We're talking theater.
Theater.
We were talking about the other day when we were having coffee.
I'm trying to think of what the roots of theater were, but I'm pretty sure that every sort of cultural group has had their own, like, expressions, like theatrical expressions. I mean, I know that now, like, present day with my show. So I'm in Mean Girls, and I'm the understudy for Regina George and Gretchen Wieners. And those are two roles that, like, knowing from the movie, that were played by white women. So it's pretty cool that, like, I get to do that and be on stage, and, you know, people get to see me, and, like, a lot of, like, little girls, like, black girls and Latin girls, they come up to me at the stage door and, like, ask for my autograph and stuff. And they're just so excited because I'm the first, like, you know, Latina Regina that they've seen, and Latina Gretchen Wieners. And, like, I think that theater is definitely making strides. There's, like, still a long way to go with that because, you know, theater is about, like, suspending reality for a moment, and, like, it's acting, you know? So I think it'd be cooler to have a little bit more of that, like, more people of color on stage. But my show, at least, is pretty diverse. Like, our ensemble, I mean, we've got, I think, half of our ensemble, or more than half, they're all people of color. All of the understudies in the show, who understudy main roles, like Aaron Samuels, Damien, Janice, they're all people of color. So, like, at one point, I was on as Regina, and then Damien's understudy, who's black, was on as Damien. And then Karen's understudy, Karen was, like, the dumb blonde.
Yeah, spills a tits for the weather.
Yeah, exactly, who's played by Amanda Seyfried. But in our show, our Karen understudy is black as well. So it was, like, us, and then all we needed, but he wasn't out.
Wait, why are the understudies, like, how many of the main actresses and actors are?
So we have, as far as principals go, there's Ashley Park, who plays Gretchen, and she's Asian. And then everyone else on stage, they've, like, it's, like, about half and half. But as far as, like, the three main girls, or the four main girls, five main girls. There's so many main women. Sorry, not girls.
There's mean girls.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I want to keep saying girls.
Listen, I've gotten jumped down my throat for calling women girls.
Yeah.
Or chicks, just because I talk very slangy.
Yeah.
I want to see your angry Regina. But
oh, gosh.
Bitchy Regina.
Yeah. I love playing it because it's really far from my personality, but it's something that, like, I love to do because, like, I never really get to get angry or, like, be bitchy. And so, It's so fun. My Regina's, like, a little bit too mean. Like, the director's like, you could tone it down a little bit and be, like, more irritated and, like, less mean. And it's like, okay, yeah. But it's just so fun to play. But, I mean, our cast is really diverse. And it's, like, it's a cool show to see not just for that reason alone, but being someone in the audience and being like, oh, well, there's, you know, Zurin who's understudying Karen and she's black. Like, that's so cool. Like, and she's a dancer. Like, and she's, a, you know, and just to see all of that. I mean, people make like fan art and like put our faces on like stickers and send them to us and like draw me. And they, like, I have portraits of, you know, my face because people, they get so excited. And like, I think that that wouldn't happen otherwise. I think people like to see themselves in other artists, you know, on stage.
Mm-hmm. So I was thinking first, so from the future, in the future, I think it's going to be extremely important. I think it's very hard to change people's minds once they've reached a certain age. So I don't think the move is, there's so much argument going on in politics and newspapers and media between people who are 25 and 35 and 65. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can change anyone's damn mind. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion. I think the children and educating young people while they're still malleable is the move to go. So seeing kids come to your stage means they're going to grow up with that mindset. Like, I can be this. Mm-hmm. I can be a person of color and be an actress in some role that maybe someone else didn't have. Yeah. Serena, we talked about Serena Venus the other day. Serena and Venus, huge role models. And I'm sure all these young girls are going to grow up now seeing that they have potential. They can be a tennis player or whatever they want to be.
Yeah. I think, and like going back to too about like changing, not being able to change people's minds. Like I read, so there are these two books that I read in college, and one of them was called The Social Contract. I don't remember who wrote these books, but one's The Social Contract, and it's like one of the like very early, like not philosophers. I don't know what he is, but he basically, it was like olden days. Like, this is what society is based on, like in Europe. And he said that at the top is white men. And then you have, I think it's like white men, white women, and then children, and then the animals, and then like men of color. Women of color were not on that list.
They put animal?
Yeah, of course. And so that was called The Social Contract. That's how people lived their lives. Like, there are direct quotes from that book where I was like, oh man, this is crazy. Like, this is not. But then you see it, you see like the history of this country and you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And then someone, a black man, he came out with something called, damn, I don't remember his name either, but he came out with something called The Racial Contract, and basically was going back and like taking those words apart and was just saying that at the end of the day, it's, he called it an epistemological change, which means it's rooted deeply in your brain and you have to change it. And so like, that's the only way that we can like spin sort of racism on its head. And because you can't do that when you're, you know, our age and above, like, it's really, really hard. So like, going back to the children and actually teaching them from that early age, like, this is what's right, this is what's wrong, that's like the only way to really do it.
Is it just an impatience on humanity that we expect things to happen in a generation, two generations, three generations? We want everything to happen in our lifetime. We expect it. And there's so much frustration that happens when we don't get the change we want to see in the world. Mm-hmm. Just in itself, when it starts with, you know, each and every individual to be a better person in order to see change in the world, to start with yourself. But I mean, it's still stuff like this takes generations. I mean, it didn't take till the British in the 1800s, like, trying to outlaw slavery, you know, literally taking tax dollars to go with ships all around, catching, you know, slave traders, freeing slaves. But then again, where is the infrastructure in society then? So, I mean, that was like 1811 or 1803. They started with the abolition of slavery. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, that's one step. And then how do you integrate these people into cultures? How do you integrate them in a world where you're talking about social contracts where they're not even seen as human beings still?
Yeah.
You know, what is it, 3/5 of a vote in the United States just in the 1860s. Mm-hmm. And then you see the institution of, you know, prison system.
Yeah.
Which locks in, you know, everybody and anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a battle. It's so hard to see the change. And that's my big complaint on society, you know, going back to the straws. How much do you want to see a world become a better place?
Yeah.
How much do we want to demand on each other and ourselves to make the world a better place? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it stems towards even racism.
Yeah.
And how we look and see view people.
Yeah.
What is the value of a human these days? Yeah, speechless. It's good.
I think they value a human at like $2.3 million. Actually, we learned that. How can you value a human being's life? Like, and what's the difference in value? But is there variance between people? Like, it seems ridiculous.
But we're looking at that with like work.
Economic.
How do we value a human being? Like, is it me going working 40 hours a week for someone else in order to make a business or a plan for them? And you know, is it them putting a ping pong table in the office or giving me, you know, work Sunday? Was it Friday summer Fridays, mm-hmm. where I can get off at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? You know, are they keeping me happy or are they making me a better person? Am I a better overall person, or am I worth a lot more than that? If I'm going to be there for that long of time, I should be demanding more money.
You should demand more out of yourself.
There you go.
Yeah, I think it's like as far as valuing, like humans are not. And I think a lot of people think differently, and that's what the problem is. And that's why, like, there is, you know, our healthcare system sucks, and like mental health in this society, like, sucks as well.
Sucks.
Because we treat humans as commodities. Like, you can't equate a human to how much they work and what they're like right now we like put humans as what their output is into society, which is very productive, and it's why this country is like, you know, such a powerhouse. But it's like, you can't say like, okay, well, this person contributes X into this society, so like that's what, you know, that's what they're worth. It's at the end of the day, it's like, and this is not even me trying to be hippy dippy, but like, if you look at it, like, we are all humans, and like, there is an inherent value that everyone's life has, and it doesn't, you know, obviously people take like different traits and skills, like, and they definitely amplify them, and so some people are worth more to others, but like, who's to say like you're worth more?
Let me disagree with you.
Let me disagree
with you, because let's say hypothetically that you could value each person's life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you knew that you needed an output. And let's say if you can raise the output of the overall value by creating a valuation of humans, what you do is you raise the average, or you innovate. And then by innovating, not only do you raise the average, but you raise the bottom to become more to the top level.
Mm-hmm. Like, so, universal basic income would do that, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So like even to bring out like a hyperbolic example that I don't necessarily agree with myself is, let's say that we gave extra money to the wealthiest people in power on the condition that they would start some sort of new business that we knew for sure – oh, those straws – that we knew for sure was going to – now they're going to make even more money by us giving them money. But what's going to happen is they're going to put out some business that is going to give the poorest people more money. Let's say 20 years from now we create some value where the poorest people get 15% of whatever company that they get. Like, I'm trying to use an example. I don't know if I'm using a great example, but I'm trying to use an example where we're creating a bigger inequality, but mm-hmm. the bigger inequality is helping the people at the lowest level make more money. So economically speaking, I'm trying to say that by creating an economic system, it is feasible conceptually to raise the total of humanity. Like,
how would you raise it? How would it be raising? Like, that the wealthiest people would, like, that the poorest people would have a stake in that company, and that would raise their like
create
money, or like that they would be taught like skills or like,
yeah, so
for that company.
So let's say that. And so in a basic level, you would say, well, more money gets funneled back into the system. But how do you enforce that money from the top levels getting put back in the system? So you can – let's say in my example that the people at the top now have to create a line of products that makes the lives easier for people who are poor. Or maybe they have to raise wages for $20 to $25 an hour for those at the bottom level by doing something like that. So mm-hmm. raising wages at the bottom level will enforce the people at the bottom level of living better lives. So yeah, the inequality grows, but the average quality of life from the bottom level raises. So people who are homeless on the streets, or people who are living in the projects and have tough lives, and you work at McDonald's, now they're having a much more beneficial, comfortable lives. They don't have to worry about their children. They might not get addicted to drugs. They can improve vastly. I'm not saying that that's the answer. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that I can view a world in which output is when you create output and kind of deviate from the individual, you can make the individual have a better life.
Hypothetically, what's the long-term trajectory of that?
That would be the only variable that would have to change. Everything else, all the other variables would have to stay the same. Cost of living would have to stay the same, because if the cost of living went up, then these people at the bottom would still be at the bottom. Like, the only variable that could change would be the output. So, like, how would you be able to control that?
That's a good point. But average cost of – so there's different ways that you can affect the input in the system. But obviously giving people access to basic needs at a cheaper rate. So so it's like inflating the economy. It's like inflation almost, but you're not inflating to the full percent. So, like, I don't know how I'm going to explain – like, I want to start explaining things mathematically, but it'll be tough. It's very complex. Like, I'm not even saying that it's necessarily true. But let's say that you did a different system where the people in power had to put recycling bin, like they had to build companies that gave recycling and fixed our ozone, or like some abstract topic. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna jump away from this topic.
Okay, it's right? Like a whole nother podcast. We're like, okay, yeah.
Because we gotta wrap it up.
I know.
But let's close it out on something. Let's close it on something positive. Because like we talked about, I think I myself am a stickler on, you know, not seeing the change that I can invoke, whether it's, you know, giving someone a powerful message or inspiring somebody from the things that I get to do on everyday basis. So take us away with something that can leave us on a positive, strong mark. That's going to unite us. It's going to bring us together. That's something that both people, color, creed, orientation.
What's your utopia, Brandon?
Not mine. We're going to her.
I know. That's what you just did.
I think it is – things are changing. I wouldn't necessarily be like, oh, they're getting so much better. But like the fact that people are talking and like they're going out there and marching, like it's almost like going back to like the marches that like our parents and grandparents like saw when they were growing up and like invoking change that way. I think that that's a really positive thing that's going on in the world right now. Like, people care enough to do something, and they care enough to actually register to vote for the first time. Like, that's super exciting to see, especially people from our generation, like posting on their Instagram and Facebook, like, last day to register to vote is this, like, come out to this march, come out to this. Like, that's super exciting to me.
Fascinating. Ashley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know we crammed this one in.
Yeah, thank you for coming
on.
Real quick,
of course. Please let someone, everybody know where they can, you know, not just connect with you, but where they can go see you perform.
Of course. Oh my gosh. So you can see me perform at the August Wilson Theater in New York, in Mean Girls. And you can also follow me on social media, Instagram at Ash De La Rosa, Twitter, Ashley De La Rosa.
Give me your... the best video for you on YouTube for anyone on The Voice.
Oh, on The Voice?
Or a great video of you singing.
There's a video on YouTube of me singing Creep by Radiohead. That's my favorite one.
Okay. Perfect.
Watch that.
I'm going to come out and check out that show.
Yeah?
I mean, how do I know you're going to be performing that?
I'll text you guys. I'll let you know. I can't like post it online, but I'll let you guys know.
Okay. Beautiful. Yeah. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in this episode. Make sure you go check out Ashley. Go check out the... what Wilson Theater?
August Wilson.
I want to make sure we plug and get you all the people coming in to see you perform. And guys, make sure you hit that subscribe button if you tuned all the way in this episode. Make sure you share this episode. Someone who really take in some great information. Share the discussion. Connect with us on the discussion. And let's keep going on what we think, how we can make this world a better place. And everybody else, thank you. Make sure you go check out our YouTube page. We just toured South America by school bus. We took a school bus from Utah all the way down there. We've been in some incredible adventures, told some crazy stories, and we're planning on doing it again. So please go check out those videos and find out a way that we can all connect and continue making some incredible content. You got anything else?
CBD.
CBD from Green Roads World. Thank you, Green Roads World. And thank you for everybody who shops through our portal at greenroadsworld.com and using that promo code on the bus. We appreciate it, and we appreciate you giving you that 15% discount on any and all CBD purchases. That's promo code on the bus, onthebus. And that one's it. The bus
is out. Yeah. Yeah,
is the move. For those who...